Sit back and relax with the Unity Tees Collection and bring a piece of Unity Village home with you. This collection of three unique tea blends are designed to help you boost your immune system and promote relaxation. Enjoy a cup of Myrtle's Grove, Labyrinth, or Rose Garden packaged in beautiful containers featuring healing affirmations and illustrations of special places around the stunning Unity Village campus in Missouri. Enjoy a cup today with someone special. Order at unity.org/shop.
All are welcome. We're glad you found us. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Learn how to eat better, get healthy, and help animals. Welcome to Main Street Vegan with your host, Victoria Moran.
I walked out of the theater committing to do all that I could to lessen the suffering of animals. The movie was Gorillas in the Mist, and I saw it in 1988. I clicked out of YouTube, committing to do all I could to help save this earth and its inhabitants. The movie was Endgame 2050, and I watched it yesterday. The filmmaker is my first guest on today's program. Hi, everybody. Thank you for tuning in for the Main Street Vegan Podcast. I am your host, Victoria Moran. In the second half of today's program, we'll be talking radiant health and disease prevention with Hans Diehl, PhD of Loma Linda University. And right now, it is my pleasure to introduce physician, environmentalist, and now filmmaker of the documentary that has most recently changed my life, Sophia Pineda Ochoa, MD. She was born and raised in Guadalajara, Mexico, where she attended medical school, and she devoted a full decade for medical training. But over time, her perspective changed on what she believes is most urgent. She's come to understand that humans, herself included, are literally destroying the planet on which we live. She believes that humanity is not only making the planet uninhabitable for human civilization, but also for the countless other species with whom we share this world. And that's why she and the wonderful musician and entertainer Moby have created this stunning new documentary, Endgame 2050. Welcome, Dr. Ochoa.
Hi, Victoria. So nice to talk to you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's delightful, and it's so much fun to hear you having just watched the film, because in addition to directing this film, and I think writing parts of it, you are the wonderful narrator, and I just felt so close to you and so like I wish you live nearby and we could go have tea whenever we can go have tea in the world again. So what a pleasure to have you on the program today. So as you know, this film blew me away. I thought I had all the information that I needed about the environment and what we could do to hopefully fix it. But I realized that I was completely in the dark. And what actually happened that made the film so powerful for me was that I started watching it night before last. So I did stop midway, and I was completely dumbfounded by everything that you talked about with the mass extinctions, with the acidification of the oceans, with the human population. And I realized the next day when I turned it on and you were just about to get to climate change, that as awful as climate change is, there is so much going on in addition. So start at the very beginning, a very good place to start, and tell me where this film was conceived.
Well, this film was conceived over time. As you know, I'm a physician, and I did medical school in Mexico, and then I came here. And then for many years, you know, like for 10 years, I was like on one work visa after another. I finally just got my green card. And so I think some of the frustrations that I had, like with the medical system, you know, as somebody who was kind of an idealist as I was, you know, going through medical school, like, oh, I'm going to help people. And then sometimes, like, just kind of faced with reality, just not feeling like I was getting that. And, you know, sometimes, you know, like with some limitations in the medical system, and also just becoming aware of the existential threats that we're facing over the last decade, you know, just becoming more aware of the environmental things that are going on the planet, that I just felt like, you know, we really need to kind of like raise awareness. Like, I think people have a good survival instinct. If they knew so much stuff was going on, maybe they would make different choices, and they would actually care if they knew that it's like their lives could be affected too, you know? So that's why I decided to make this film.
Well, I'm so glad you did, and I think your instincts were right on. Well, one of the things that I feel now is when I speak with people who are climate deniers or who just want to blow off the climate part, I don't have to try to convince them about climate. I can just talk with them about some of the other things, because the response to all of them are the same. So you certainly lit a fire under me. So I want to start, Sophia, with probably the part of the film that is even more controversial than the suggestion that people should go vegan. And that is the part about human population. I was just thrilled that you had on Dr. Paul Ehrlich, whose 1968 book, Population Bomb, I read in 1968. In fact, I think I had to read it for a class in high school. And that was such a big issue. And in the late 60s, the early 70s, population zero, population growth. And then somehow it just faded away as if it had all been taken care of. So talk with us about human population, what the problem is, and why we started ignoring it.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't really have to. You can just look at some of the numbers to kind of get a better idea of what's going on. And I mentioned some of them in the film. You know, right now, we're adding about a net growth. Right now, we're in an environmental overshoot. So we're consuming more resources that the planet can sustainably support. And that goes for pretty much everything, like even like soil that we use for food. You know, we're degrading it into dirt at a very fast rate, so that, you know, and I didn't even go into that into the film. But anyway, so the projections are like we're in an environmental overshoot. And despite that, you're right, we kind of stopped having that conversation, and because, you know, I haven't been doing that conversation, like, you know, for a long time. I think that what happened was that perhaps some of the projections, like the catastrophic projections, I think maybe some of them didn't turn out. Like maybe someone who wrote in the book said, oh, England is going to be underwater or something like that. And so people just dismissed it all, like, oh, there's no problem with population. We can keep adding a billion people to the planet every 12 years and there's no issue. So I think some of the problem why the issue was kind of swept under the rug was that. And also I think, I don't know, I think there may have been some racism involved in some of it, which is totally wrong and which should not be the case, because population is a global issue. It's not about one race or another. You know, we all have a footprint. Actually, developed worlds consume a lot more per individual than another country, which may be having a higher growth rate. So we all matter. Every single one of us matters. But I think to answer the question, I think that may have been what That's just my theory, why people kind of stop talking about it. But the fact is, you know, if you think about it, Victoria, you know, just about 200 years ago, there was 1 billion people on the planet in the early 1800s. And I think 1804 is what they said was, you know, the population census of 1 billion. And now we're almost 8, you know. Actually, when I started making the film, the population was, I think, around 7.4. And when I finished it, it was 7.8. So even the film was outdated by the time it had finished. And so it affects all of the things in the planet, you know. No matter how much we try to be angels and consume as little as possible, and, you know, even if we were all Greta Thunbergs and you're just little angel trying to consume, the fact is we all consume, you know, resources, and that has a profound impact on the environment. You know, I'm from Mexico, as I mentioned, and even though, like, the film has a strong emphasis on animal agriculture, rightly so, because it's disproportionate the amount of resources that industry uses in a very inefficient way to feed humanity. Like, for example, in Mexico, where I'm from, there's a lot of deforestation happening because of avocado, which is crazy, you know? Now that avocado is being exported to the world and everybody loves it, thousands of acres just in Mexico are being leveled for that. So it really is, no matter how you cut it, something that affects the entire planet and all of the inhabitants, all of the animals who we share it with. Sorry for the long-winded answer.
No, it's a wonderful answer, because I think these are things we really do need to be looking at. I thought that Dr. Ehrlich was so great in the film when he said that it's ridiculous to say that the number of people doesn't matter, that it's all about consumption, and also we're consuming too much, certainly people in the developed world. So you touch on population. You also get into ocean acidification, which I was somewhat familiar with, but you really explain it much better. Why is ocean acidification a problem, and why do we have it?
It's quite simple, actually. It's simply because we're putting a lot of CO2 in the environment, and about a third of it gets absorbed by the ocean. So in addition to warming up the ocean with the CO2 that it absorbs heat, and in addition to, you know, putting all the waste that we are doing, the CO2 that we release into the environment turns into carbonic acid in the ocean, and it is acidifying it, and it's already having direct measurable effects. So the pH has decreased, and it is projected to decrease further by the end of the century. The pH has decreased from pre-industrial times from 8.2 to 8.1, which seems like, oh, just a 0.1. But yeah, it seems like so little, all these changes that we do. But actually, if you live in the ocean, you know, that's a huge change. You know, imagine if they decreased the concentration of the air that we breathe, you know. And it is having a very profound impact, even right now, before or with the changes that we're already doing in the ocean. Actually, the animals that have shells, that need the shells to protect their bodies to survive, like crabs or for example, like the oysters, the oyster industry is having... they had to be moved, like the film mentions, it had to be moved from the West Coast to Hawaii because the water there was too acidic for them to survive. So, you know, I feel like that's just like a canary in the coal mine. You know, if the oysters can't survive in the ocean, then do we have to, like, move them? Like, how is that acceptable? You know, how is that not an alarming thing? And when one thing that I do mention in the film, for anyone who may think, well, the oysters, you know, that doesn't really affect me directly, you know, that's really sad for the oysters or the crabs, but I don't have shells in my body. The thing is, because we're all interconnected, one point that I made sure to highlight in the film is that half of the oxygen that we breathe comes from the ocean, from tiny little creatures called phytoplankton, these plants that produce oxygen, just like the plants on Earth produce, on land produce oxygen. So these things are susceptible to warming and to acidification. So we can't be so, you know, so careless and think, well, it's the ocean, it doesn't affect me. You know, we're actually all, we're interconnected, and we are very much dependent on the environment that supports us, just like the crabs are or the oysters are.
Yes. Well, you talked a lot about the ocean, and one of the things that was really a wake-up call for me was about the plastics. I mean, I've known that plastics aren't great, and so I try to use other things when it's convenient, but now I understand I need to use other things when it's inconvenient. I need to go on a plastic fast and let it last a day at a time as long as I live. So why is that a good idea?
Well, it's a good idea because, you know, plastic is great because it's so durable. That's why we love it. You know, that's why it's so convenient and wonderful for packing everything. But because it's so durable, it also lasts in the environment for as long as it does and doesn't really degrade, you know, when we throw it in the ocean or when it reaches the ocean, even if we throw it in the garbage can and it reaches the ocean, it just dissolves into tiny little microplastics that actually, you know, we had a very big section on those that we eliminated entirely from the film because there was just wasn't enough time. But I mean, these microplastics, they affect the animals. They affect, you know, because it affects even it's getting into the salt. So it really comes back to haunt us, you know. You know, in the film, I focus mostly just on the fish because they are objectively and measurably showing a lot of plastic pieces in people who eat fish, and we can see them. But even if you don't eat fish, you know, it still is, you know, I mean, I eat salt, you know, and I don't want to be eating plastic fibers in my salt, and the animals are paying the ultimate price. Right now we see on the news every day whales who washed out ashore filled with their stomachs filled with plastic bags because the poor whales, they're filter feeders. They open up their huge mouths, take in thousands of gallons of water, and then push the water out through the sides, and they filter everything in because it's supposed to be food for them. But now if you're a filter feeder in the ocean, what you're keeping inside of your mouth is plastic bags. So it's so sad. Like, I feel like so sad for the whales that are dying because they have plastics in their stomach. And it goes the same for smaller animals as well. You know, I think we also took this out from the film, a figure that talked about how I think 93% of seabird species now have plastic in their stomachs. And how sad, like these poor birds, you know, they for millions of years, or you know, they were eating the things that they thought were food from the ocean, and now they think it's food and they feed it to their chicks. They bring it back to their nest and they're giving it to their chicks, and they're actually giving them plastic and their chicks are dying. So it's just not right. But I understand it's a very inconvenient thing to do, and I think that plastic in particular is one of the things where we really kind of need a top-down approach, like a system-wide change to some biodegradable things, you know, because it's very, very hard to, I admit it is very hard to avoid it because yes. Everything from food to temp becomes wrapped in plastic. So it's really hard, but I guess we need to do what we can.
Well, I was doing some research this morning. My husband reminded me that there is also a problem with microplastics in a lot of the body care and toiletry items that people use. And I was looking at those. And what it seems is that the very expensive, upscale, cruelty-free, natural brands don't have that. And they also seem to be packaged in glass. But so little in the more affordable lines comes that way. And I was very proud of a company called The Fanciful Fox that's online. It's also in Brooklyn. One of my Main Street Vegan Academy graduates and her mother are behind The Fanciful Fox. And I hadn't even thought about it until watching your film and looking in my cabinet this morning. that they package everything in glass. It's expensive. There's a lot of waste, I've read, when a company uses glass, you know, since it breaks. But how wonderful that some companies are going the extra mile to do the right thing here. And also in watching your film, I realized that environmentalism is an animal rights issue. You know, we always talk about veganism being this three-legged stool of animal rights and health and the environment, when they really are all together, and certainly doing these things to save the planet are also saving the animals. So what did you discover about climate change, and is it too late?
I don't want to say that it's too late, but it's just very simple. You know, it baffles me sometimes how it's like, there's like, people talk about like controversy. It's so simple. It's about the physical properties of some gases, and we call them greenhouse gases. And the simple thing about it is that they absorb heat, and so that results in the climate, you know, being warmer and being more disruptive. And one thing that I focused in the film, again, because the entire film I was trying to evoke, you know, like concern, and, you know, so I focused on a situation with methane, with the methane, which is increasingly concerning, because we have permafrost that's forming methane, and we have methane clathrates under the ocean, which is these frozen things of methane, these huge amounts, much more than the methane that's in the environment. And as we warm up, you know, there's a very big risk of these methane large bodies coming up, which could be push recovery kind of out of reach. So, I mean, that's why I feel like people hear a lot about climate change, and that was kind of my focus in the film. I wanted to focus a little bit on those. But, I mean, the bottom line is that it needs to be like aggressive action on that, and that's why I also brought up, you know, your diet, because sometimes technology can be expensive, and we all need to move to renewable energy as quickly as possible. But of course, that also sometimes has its own impact. And even though we need to do it, you know, there's some other things that we can also take in addition to that, like changing our diet, which could be very, very helpful for that. And so,
yes. I had a friend who went to a climate conference, and she said most of the scientists are just depressed, but the few who say there is hope say that the hope comes from a plant-based diet and composting our garbage. And to me, that gives me a lot of hope, because that's something that we can do as individuals and that we can encourage our friends to do. So the film, everybody, seriously, you must see this film. You can watch it absolutely free on YouTube or on the website endgame2050.com. And I just want you to describe a little bit about how you did it, that you teamed with Moby, and he had some amazing things to say. He's a great storyteller. And then you started out with a little fictional, futuristic feature film, which kept coming up through the documentary. Tell us why you decided to do it that way.
It was just a desperate attempt to make it, like, in my mind, like, entertaining. I was like, well, this data is so compelling, but, you know, maybe if I put something, you know, I am from Mexico, and in Mexico, people love telenovelas. I don't, but I know that people get drawn to them. So in my mind, I was like, well, what if I put a little telenovela in the beginning, and maybe that way and keep coming back to that, like a telenovela that it takes place in the year 2050. And maybe that will, like, create all this body of information more watchable. So that was my thinking behind that. And Moby is great in the film. He's very direct, he's very assertive, so I'm really glad that he's in it. He really wasn't involved in the making of the film. Like, I actually had finished the film and then got an interview with him, and then incorporated all of his stuff while taking stuff from the film that I had already finished. But it was, in my mind, so important to have him in there, because he just speaks with such, you know, he doesn't you know, he's so assertive that I thought it was just wonderful that to have.
Well, he's also very clear, very humble. Even his opening story in the film is about a guy who was drunk and high on heroin and just thought life was great and he was feeling wonderful and had this terrible car accident that cost him his legs and took the lives of two of his friends. But until that moment, they thought everything was great. And his point is that that's where we are now. We know about these things, kind of, sort of, and yet we're living as if it's not really true. So a film like yours is just so incredibly important. And everybody, it is so watchable. I watched it twice. I watched it because I knew that Dr. Ochoa was going to be on my show. Then I watched it again with my husband. And I was just enraptured both times. So just in our last minute, what do you want people to know?
I want people to know that they were facing existential challenges that should be on the cover of every newspaper every single day. And that if we don't take aggressive action and really care about these things, we could, I guess the one thing that we could be facing them in our lifetime, because it's not, people say, oh, it's just my grandchildren. No, we're talking about in our lifetime. So if we want to be happy and have a livable life, you know, we need to really pay attention to what we're doing to the environment. And that's it, I think.
Well, thank you. It's an absolutely beautiful film. Everybody, Endgame 2050. It's on that website, endgame2050.com. It is on YouTube. It is free. Watch it. Send it to everybody you know. And thank you so much for doing this beautiful work. Everybody else, stay with us. Thank you, Dr. Ochoa. We'll be back with Dr. Hans Diehl and getting you super healthy.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome back to Main Street Vegan with your host, Victoria Moran.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us today. If you'd like to know more about what goes on at Main Street Vegan, you can check us out at mainstreetvegan.net. So there is really a lot happening there. We have our wonderful Main Street Vegan Academy that trains and certifies vegan lifestyle coaches and educators. We've always done that live and in person in New York City, and the plan is to do that again in the summer of 2021. But in between now and then, we are doing that training on Zoom. So that makes it very affordable, very convenient. So do check that out. And also our blog and the film that I produced last year, A Prayer for Compassion, and lots more going on. And right now, I am so happy to be introducing to you someone that I have met at the Vegetarian Summerfest. It's now going to be called Vegan Summerfest. And he's been one of my favorite speakers because he is so direct, so to the point, and so practical. And he is Hans Diehl, PhD. More than 85,000 people have graduated from the 35-hour educational program that he developed. It's known as the CHIP program. You've probably heard of it. It stands for Complete Health Improvement Program. And it has a stellar track record in addressing diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, heart disease, depression. Dr. Diehl is clinical professor of preventive medicine in the School of Medicine at Loma Linda University, and his books have sold, just 2 million copies in 36 languages. Welcome, Dr. Hans Diehl.
Thank you, Victoria. It's a pleasure being on your program. I've always admired you as a responsible sane voice in a crazy culture right now.
Thank you so much for that. It means a lot, because I think, don't you, Dr. Deal, that just because we eat in a way that is outside the norm, sometimes people think that that sets up a barrier to looking at what we have to offer. And yet you and our wonderful plant-based physicians can offer so much science to back it up. So I think that's where we're going to reach a lot of people.
They just haven't caught on yet to the idea that we are the only ones that are right.
that's the argument to make. Tell us,
Victoria,
seriously, how did the CHIP program develop? Where did that come from for you?
Well, you know, I grew up in Germany under very humble circumstances after World War II. We basically grew all of our food, whatever we could grow in our gardens. We grew up with basically a very simple diet, foods as grown. And that has sort of shaped me. When I came to North America, I recognized that there was a great opportunity for self-fulfillment, and I had a Christian orientation. I had a commitment to a service-oriented career, and I recognized that in North America, you have this concept of social upward mobility, and which we didn't have in Germany in those days. And so I recognized I could become anything I wanted to be if I really applied myself. And so I chose to go into medicine, went to the Canadian mines, worked in mines there to earn my tuition, and then came to Loma Linda University here in Southern California, an Adventist Christian medical school, and was waiting to get into medical school when I read this article in the Reader's Digest called Valleys of Beautiful Widows. And it was a story about a region in Finland, North Karelia, where they have the highest rate of heart disease, the highest rates of cholesterol, and men often died at the age of 35, 45, 50 years, leaving behind beautiful young women. You know, and this was where the article title came from, Valley of Beautiful Widows. And these widows became so concerned about losing their husbands, if they still had some, that they called on the Finnish government and said, please send us someone to help us here. We need to have something more than just doctors that are taking care of symptoms and managing the disease. We want to turn this disease off. We want to prevent it. So they sent a young epidemiologist by the name of Pekka Puska, and he said, yeah, I can see why we have the highest rates of heart disease here in this area. We need to do something about our consumption patterns in our foods. This is a diet that's very high in fats, lots of dairy products, lots of meat. Then there's also smoking, lots of salt, and we need to make some changes. And while his emphasis was initially kind of, poo-pooed, not taken seriously by his medical colleagues, the women were very serious. And they said, please, why don't you pick a woman from each of these villages here in these areas here and train them, and then they will go back and train the women of the villages, and then they will prepare the food so it ought to be prepared for the husbands. That's what they did. And 40 years later, 80% of the heart disease deaths were no longer there. They almost had wiped out heart disease in that area of Finland because they made some of these basic changes in their lifestyle. Big story. And as a result of this, I was introduced, while waiting, getting into medical school, I was introduced by the dean of the School of Public Health, and he said to me, you know, Hans, why don't you come and take a look at our new program in the School of Public Health called a Doctorate in Health Science, which combines the first 2 years of medical school and then the last 2 years of public health. And our program will be preparing people not just to deal with medical care one-on-one, one doctor, one patient, but, you know, you can reach out to large population groups You can lecture with this knowledge. You can become involved in the media, because we need to make changes in our culture. Unless we transform our culture, unless we transform our society, the living habits, we will not take care of these killer diseases that are prominent in our society.
Well, you mentioned Loma Linda University being Seventh-day Adventist, and I think most people who are vegan know about some of the Adventist health studies. But why is it that there's this one Protestant denomination that is really carrying the torch for vegetarianism and healthy living in general?
Yeah, you know, Dan Buettner listed Loma Linda as one of the blue zones in the world, which have the longest living people. And Loma Linda is sort of a symbol of the longest living people, centenarians, in the North American society. You know, like last night we received a phone call, and one of our friends called us up and said, "This is Benita, 105 years of age, sparkling, energetic, recognizing us very, very well, and making the call to see that we're doing okay when she's 105. So this is Loma Linda, and the story goes that this is not just Loma Linda where people live the longest. It's anywhere in the world where you have Adventists. Adventist Christians live on the average 8 to 16 years longer than anybody else, regardless of what society they are in. So if I do a research project in Japan and I study Adventists, they will live about 10 years longer there than the Japanese people. Then you can go to Poland and study Adventists there, and they live about 8 to 12 years longer than other Polish people. And the same thing here in North America. Wherever you find Adventists, you find that they're living longer. And what is very interesting is that the Adventists divide themselves into, shall we say, four major dietary subgroups. Adventists in general believe in getting enough sleep, being a nice person, being service-oriented, be educationally aligned. They believe in education. They believe in the constancy of marriage. You know, that's the ideal. They believe in exercise. They believe in no smoking, no alcohol. These are concepts that Adventists have embraced since 1863, when a person who felt inspired and has been seen as one of the co-founders of the Adventist Christian community expressed concern that people were dying unnecessarily, particularly in those days, and she recommended that people should ideally follow a diet that is plant-based, and that would be more foods as grown, as they're prepared, as they come in nature. So this is the background to this concept. And so the Adventist Church has always advocated no smoking, no alcohol, be careful with caffeine, you know, get enough sleep, these kind of things, these lifestyle issues that are now considered to be called lifestyle medicine concepts. But within the Adventist Church, the church never said, you have to become a vegan. The Adventist Church said it is preferable to move towards food as it comes in nature, simply prepared without all the sugar and oil and the salt and so on. Keep it simple. And so the Adventist community around the world is divided, where about half of the Adventists, particularly in North America, half of the Adventists are vegetarian, meat eaters. Okay, they're consuming animal products. Then you have the other half of the Adventists are the basic vegetarians. Some of them eat fish. Some of them eat dairy products and eggs. And then 1/10 or 10% of all the Adventists are total vegans. And this is very important for us to think about, because remember, here is now a group, a worldwide global community that has a unique homogeneous lifestyle, except in one area. And that's, they're slightly different dietary divisions among themselves. And this is why the government was so eager to call on the Adventist community at the Loma Linda University here. And they said, look, you are the scientific center of the Adventist global community. Why don't you turn in a grant proposal and study the Adventist differences in disease occurrence among these four different dietary groups? Right?
Right.
And what did you find out?
And
so they have been doing this since 1958. And, for instance, they found that Adventists in 1958 had virtually very, very little lung cancer. And it was the first indication that maybe smoking and lung cancer could possibly be related. That came out of the Adventist presence. Furthermore, they found again and again and again, particularly in the last 10, 15 years, in this large Adventist health study number 2, where they enrolled some 97,000 people in North America. They followed them very, very, very carefully. They know everything about these people, their diet and so on. Followed them for 7 years, and they found that the Adventist meat eaters had 5 times more cholesterol to be treated. They had 4 times more diabetes to be treated among the meat eaters when compared to the vegans. And they had about 4 times more, we talked about diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, always 4 to 5 times more frequently found in Adventist meat eaters when compared to vegans. And then, of course, you looked at the vegetarians that were fish eaters, and you looked at the vegetarians that were lacto-ovo-vegetarians, and there were 3 in between. So the point of the Adventist study then has been that the further you move towards a plant-based whole food diet, the more protected you are from these chronic diseases that are so common in our society that are responsible for 70% of our deaths.
Well, it's utterly fascinating. And as you were speaking, Dr. Deal, I pulled off my bookshelf Ellen G. White's Counsels on Diet and Foods, which she wrote, I believe you said, in 1863. And as you leaf through this book and just look at the headings, it's as if you're reading something from a medical journal that came out last week. You know, some obviously of the wording is a little bit archaic, but the basics that she's talking about is just what people are coming to know today. So you have quite a stunning history there. So I know that in the CHIP program, you have an 8-point plan for regaining and maintaining health. So maybe you could just recite those 8 points to us, and then in our 12 minutes or so that we have left to speak, you can go into a little detail on some of them. So what are the 8 points?
Yeah, you know, these 8 points have been summarized by this lady that you mentioned, Ellen G. White, who has written over 100,000 pages published. She is the most published female writer in the world with regard to serious topics. There's only one woman more than her, that's Agatha Christie, and that's not so much of serious literature, but it's more for entertainment. So Ellen G. White, yes, talked about the natural doctors. She talked about the idea even then that some of the strange pharmaceutical products that were then in vogue were not really treating the cause of disease, but they were basically just managing the symptoms, and, you know, not very much really has changed when it comes to today's pharmacological interventions. And so she recommended we need to go to the root cause of these common chronic diseases such as heart disease and type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure and depression and overweight. And she said these are related to 8 factors, root factors, and she we put them into a word called New Start, N-E-W, New, N-E-W, and then Start, S-T-A-R-T. And here's what she suggested would be wise to consider for good health. Number one, simple nutrition, N. foods as grown. Lots of greens, lots of fruits and vegetables, you know, lots of whole grains, food as it comes in nature. Then the E stands for a daily exercise program. Work in the garden, get into an exercise program, walk. Don't be a couch potato, we would say today. So exercise daily, get your 10,000 steps in. N-E-W, water. She advocated to drink lots of water. She didn't specify how many glasses, but many researchers today think that hydration is in short supply in our society. We should have at least 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 glasses of water a day, fluids. Not alcohol, not coffee, but basically water, good water. So that's N-E-W, new. Then comes start. S stands for sunshine. She recommended that people should, when they exercise, they should ideally do it outdoors, especially get as much work done outside as you can. So sunshine, vitamin D, it's all there. Then she talked about tea, new start, S-T. She talked about temperance. Don't be extreme. You know, just be a nice person. Don't position yourself at the right or left side, but try to be reasonable, especially when it comes to social interactions. And be also very, very careful when it comes to things that might actually be hurtful, such as alcohol, tobacco, and so on. She was very, very clear on those. So then you have New Start, N-E-W-S-T. We talked about temperance. Then you have A, stands for air, fresh air. Get those windows open at night when you go to bed. Let fresh air come in if possible. Be outdoors, you know, spend at least, you know, some time outdoors every day. Avoid bad air. You know, that means, of course, no vaping, no smoking. And then you have R, new start, R, rest. You know, be sure you get adequate sleep. Again, in our society today, most of us get 6, 7 hours of sleep. Much of the research indicates that maybe it might be better if we would have more like 6, 7, 8, 9 hours of sleep at night, go to bed early, and get up early in the morning. This is sort of what the wisdom was that she offered at the time. She talked about that the sleeping hours before midnight might be more beneficial than the hours after midnight. So again, these all have been largely confirmed by scientific research. And then the last one was new start, the T, new start, new start with a D. That was divine or trust in yourself and in purposeful living, trusting God as a source that is available to us. You know, live a purpose-driven life. So this is a new start, 8 natural remedies. And, you know, today when we look at these chronic diseases, if you really want to prevent these diseases, if you want to heal these diseases, if you want to turn these diseases around, you have a very good chance to do that by following these 8 simple, natural, shall we say, doctors.
Oh, I love them. And we are going to list those on the show notes at mainstreetvegan.net, where we'll also have information where you can contact both of our guests. And if you want some of the free literature and free helpful information from the CHIP program, you can just go to www.chiphealth.com/free. So we'll put those in the show notes as well, chiphealth.com/free. So as I look at the new start, Dr. Deal, we've got nutrition, exercise, water, sunshine, temperance, air, rest, and trust in God and purposeful living and yourself or your higher self, however people interpret that. So will you just pick one of these that is sometimes overlooked that you particularly like to talk about and tell us a little bit more about that one?
Well, you know, I like to perhaps try to make the point that today with the coronavirus epidemic, we know that people that have these comorbidities, people that have these underlying chronic diseases such as heart disease and overweight and diabetes type 2 and hypertension and depression, these people, when it comes to in-hospital deaths from the virus, the rates are three times higher when people have these underlying pathological conditions. So therefore, these natural doctors would not only help with these chronic diseases, but they would probably also be very, very outstanding in strengthening the immune system in people that have caught the virus. They would have much more power to repel and combat this virus if they wouldn't have these underlying conditions. And so when it comes to the virus situation, I think that one of the most powerful interventions, one of the most powerful preventive aspects in terms of our modern killer diseases would have to be nutrition. I think we have to move as far toward a whole food, plant-based diet as we can. That means lots of green leafy vegetables, broccoli, spinach, kale, bell peppers, these kind of things. Lots of fruits such as strawberries and blueberries and blackberries and cranberries and pomegranates. These are all antioxidants. That's what you want. And then also we want to enjoy more high-fiber foods such as whole grains, beans and lentils, fruits and avocados. Avocados are actually high in fiber, surprisingly. These are foods that are all very high in nutrient content that would help the body develop a healthy microbiome, the immune system, and reduce inflammation and give us a spectrum of micronutrients to maximize our health. So I think you also at the same time want to sideline or preferably move towards eliminating animal products such as meats and hamburgers, eggs and dairy, and perhaps even let go of these obviously processed and engineered taste sensations, you know, these processed foods that are high in sugar, fat and calories, but they are very poor in nutrition and fiber. So I think here's a prescription that would help us with the chronic diseases. And if you perhaps add some garlic, which has antibacterial and antiviral effects, you might also help yourself in terms of making yourself less vulnerable to the virus, where we actually not only practice public health concepts like distancing and wearing a mask and so on, but we also begin to look at these eight natural doctors that were recommended more than 150 years ago by a lovely lady by the name of Ellen G. White, who's one of the books that you listed earlier on your shelf there.
Well, it's fascinating to read her, and it is fascinating to listen to you. And I think that one of the amazing things that you do in the CHIP program and everybody at Loma Linda is that you take this wisdom that has been around a very long time, and then you subject it to scientific scrutiny, and what you come out with is unassailable. The history is there. The proof is in the whole food pudding. So thank you so very much, Dr. Hanstiel. Bless you. And to everybody listening, God bless you too. And eat all your veggies.
Thank you for listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
C-
Sit back and relax with the Unity Tees Collection and bring a piece of Unity Village home with you. This collection of three unique tea blends are designed to help you boost your immune system and promote relaxation. Enjoy a cup of Myrtle's Grove, Labyrinth, or Rose Garden packaged in beautiful containers featuring healing affirmations and illustrations of special places around the stunning Unity Village campus in Missouri. Enjoy a cup today with someone special. Order at unity.org/shop.